Investors Chronicle.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the IT Interviews. I'm Dave Baxter. I'm the funds editor on the Investors Chronicle. And joining me today is Rosemary Banyard. Rosemary is a highly experienced investor in the UK small and mid-cap space. Earlier in her career, she spent some time as an investment analyst before joining Schroders in the late 1990s, where she developed a strong reputation for her work on small and mid-cap funds. More recently, she'd have a stint at Sanford Dayland, the firm perhaps best known for its Buffetology fund. And in 2020, she joined Downing to launch its Unique Opportunities Fund, focusing on companies with intangible assets, cost advantages versus their peers, and other deep competitive moats that should give them superior returns. So, Rosemary, thanks for joining me. How are you doing?
Fine. Thank you very much.
So, this always seems like a slightly cursed word, but a very, I suppose, topical moment for a fund like yours. It's been, a fairly tough year or so for kind of UK small and mid caps. The UK also has kind of run into, slightly wavering, not always the kind of strongest sentiment. But, you know, we can be more upbeat, we can be more contrarian, and look at kind of what the opportunities are there, what, you know, people can capitalize on. But I guess to start off, it would just be interesting to touch on how you're kind of viewing the portfolio, how you're viewing the market in the light of, the new regime, some might call it. You know, we have higher interest rates, we have kind of new challenges facing fund managers compared with what we might have seen a few years ago.
Yeah, so I feel that the many challenges that we face, particularly when I think back to the time since I launched this fund in March 2020, right at the height of the first COVID outbreak, that the many challenges since then really arise from two main things. One is geopolitical events, and you know, we immediately think about the invasion of Ukraine, which has got knock-on effects on energy prices and food prices, and on military suppliers, and perhaps many other things, but also geopolitical knock-ons perhaps in Africa. And then, of course, we've got the potential threat of China and Taiwan. So that's one whole category. And the other, of course, is COVID. And the knock-on effects of that have been somewhat of a different set of things. So initially, obviously, lockdowns, enormous difficulties getting hold of staff, supply chain issues, logistics issues, many but not all of which have slowly resolved. But then also the Great Resignation and ongoing labour shortages around the world, and knock-on effects of inflation, wage inflation particularly. And that's one whole other set of challenges. So in the face of all of that, actually, my strategy is totally unchanged. So as you said, you know, I'm looking to invest in companies with identifiable moats, things that keep out the competition, and companies that have superior returns on equity, superior margins, really good positions, and in the main, companies without much debt, if any. Those in the main have weathered this time well, not without issues, but, you know, pretty well. So I've got just over 30 holdings, and actually only two of them ever needed to raise any money at all. Both of them were very small placings. So, you know, there doesn't seem to have been a great reason to change tack. And as we enter this, I think, permanently higher interest rate environment, you know, back to the kind of rates that I've been used to for a lot of my working life, there are still severe adjustments going on, I think, out there. But it does feel better to be still in companies with strong market positions and strong balance sheets, because in this environment, the strong get stronger and the weak tend to, you know, get weaker.
I suppose what examples could you give me of kind of any particular companies you see have been kind of benefiting from these challenging times. And I guess something we can move on to is, I suppose, sectors and areas where there might be, it might be kind of worth investors kind of doing some of their research. There must be some opportunities thrown up by, I suppose, the kind of the various states of turmoil and uncertainty that you outlined before.
Yeah, there's quite a lot, aren't there? I suppose one company that comes to mind, and you know, it's fairly topical, would be Darnell, which you know, I'm sure most people know, the leading homewares retailer in the UK, which has just put out full year results. And I suppose, although it's probably only in a part of the market that they service, the fact that, you know, Wilko has gone into administration and many of their stores will shut won't do Dunelm any harm, you know, in certain areas of its business where perhaps it's seeking to attract customers looking for, you know, value, deep value product.
Mm.
That would be one that immediately came to mind, where Dunelm is still gaining market share, even though it has over 10% of the homewares market. Is still that share is still going up. And of course, as you know, department stores have been closing, and dare one say it, even John Lewis has been shutting a few stores, you know, they've been benefiting on all of these fronts. So that, you know, that would be a pretty clear example of the strong getting stronger.
Are there generally, this is perhaps quite a broad point, but are there any particular things in times like these that are quite difficult that you would expect to see from management teams? I mean, I guess in the case of Dunelm, it seems that Dunelm has at least been pretty, I suppose, proactive, for example, accelerating its new store openings and so on. So that perhaps that's an encouraging, you know, element of behaviour. But are there other things you would kind of look for from the teams at the helms of these companies?
Yeah. Yeah. So as you say, they don't open many stores a year, but they have announced recently that they see a clear opportunity to open a few more in the next 2 years than they have been doing. I'd say generally, for the companies that are strong and have good returns on capital, on the whole, one wants them to continue investing in these times and, you know, getting into a stronger position, and that might be just continuing to expand whatever their product or service is. Well, one of the challenges at the moment is that there clearly have been businesses that have benefited significantly during COVID and lockdowns, etc. And some of that, if you call it exceptional demand, has now sort of fallen away, and some of them, you know, now seem clearly to have had exceptional trading, which hasn't continued.
Mm.
You know, one might, for example, one thinks about computer games sector, where, you know, everyone was at home and they were all playing games. And then now they're not, but there's a huge supply of games because a lot of the people that design games, kept on producing. So you've got this sort of double whammy. So that's an area of challenge. So there are areas like that which are, are seen now to be more difficult. But interestingly, a company like Games Workshop, which is one of my big holdings, seems to be going from strength to strength. So they have recently announced very strong trading. Now, people will probably know Games Workshop producing, you know, Fantasy Warriors, and it's largely still a physical activity, but they have been very much over the last 5 years seeking to monetize their very considerable intellectual property with considerable success. So royalties are now an increasing element in their revenues, but the core business continues to grow. And Games Workshop makes I think something over 50% return on equity, which is very high. It has no debt. So we, you know, I'd want them to keep investing at those rates. You know, why wouldn't you?
And Games Workshop is a very interesting one, always very popular amongst our readers, I guess, because performance has been so strong over the years. But I suppose that performance tends to lead to a valuation that perhaps some would view as a little bit rich, at least in the context of the broader market.
Yeah.
I suppose when you're backing these kind of winners and those valuation questions come up, what kind of metrics do you look at, or, you know, what do you assess when you're trying to decide whether it is worth kind of paying that perhaps higher price?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I think a lot of people look at the wider market and say, well, that looks expensive. But I would say they should look at valuations in the context of the returns on capital, the returns on equity that a company is making. Because, you know, over time, if you can earn superior returns and keep reinvesting at those returns, you will pull away. Absolutely pull away. If you think about a graph and you have a low return on capital business, and it might be growing and going up from left to right, but if you've got a higher return business, it will be pulling away with a much steeper line. Envisage that. And so you've got to look at these businesses in relation to that dynamic rather than against the market. So to give you numbers on that, I mean, broadly speaking, the UK stock market achieves a return on equity of between 12 and 14% after tax, depending on whether you're looking at mid-year or the end of year. There's roughly that range. You know, the average return on equity in this fund is over 30%. So these businesses are more than twice as profitable in their use of the capital that they have. Now, why is that important? Well, it's quite important when you've got higher inflation, because if you've got a lot of capital, whether that's a factory or people or dock or, debtors, you're owing people money. If you've got that all inflating up because prices of goods are going up, or because, yes, the price of replacing your factory or whatever is going up, then if you've got a low return on capital, you're going to be using effectively all your profit to just stand still in that environment. Yeah. Whereas if you've got a very high return, you can afford to sort of keep growing, you know, in real terms. And I think because we've had a low interest rate environment and a low inflation environment for a long time, people have kind of forgotten about, if you want to call it inflation accounting, and what happens when you've got high inflation is it's quite a struggle to keep just to stand still.
Yes, it's kind of a new way of thinking, isn't it? I suppose it's interesting. There are many investors and many people interested in kind of stock picking and so on that perhaps haven't really seen this kind of world of high or non-zero interest rates.
Yeah. And so that's inflation, but interest rates as well, as you say. And there's clearly big effects from higher rates, which we are seeing and which are coming out, you know, as we speak daily. So some are obvious. I mean, obviously the government's got a lot of debt, so they're having to pay a lot more for that. I mean, the country's interest bill is terrifying. You've got private equity, who've had fantastic time for 10 years, suddenly facing a lot higher costs. And, you know, I suspect we haven't seen the last of that particular trend. And then you've got some, you know, just businesses which have thought they could cope with, you know, higher debt, and suddenly their interest costs are really painful, and they're going to, in some cases, have to come to the market, or, you know, to, if they're listed, to raise more capital from shareholders. I do see it, the higher interest rates, there are pushes and pulls throughout the chain. So a company I own, which has been more of a struggle, is called Strix, and they make, you know, kettle controls, and they are the world leader, but they have had quite a bit of debt, and they've just had results with, you know, interest charges a lot higher than before. And one of the comments they've made is that whereas they might have had, say, 8 weeks of visibility on shipping the controls to the kettle manufacturers, they're now finding that the orders are smaller and more frequent. So that's because their customers are trying to manage their cash flow better. And so you're going to have all these pushes and pulls in the in supply chain, some of which we're more aware of or less. I'm glad that I only have 7 out of 31 holdings in my fund with any debt at all, and only three with anything approaching meaningful debt. And I'd probably say I wish I didn't have any with any debt. It is quite tough out there.
And I suppose kind of bearing that broad context in mind, I mean, I think about, for example, you allude to the kind of cost of living challenges people are facing and that kind of thing. Does the current context have any other bearing on where you would steer the portfolio? For example, would you at this point perhaps be a bit more wary of kind of consumer exposure, that kind of thing?
Well, I wouldn't say that I have a lot of consumer exposure at the best of times. So I mentioned Dunelm and Games Workshop, but they're probably exceptions rather than the rule. And this is mainly because a lot of consumer-facing businesses, say retailers or restaurants, are quite hard to define enduring barriers to entry. It's just too easy for someone else to set up in competition. And so, you know, as you said, a lot of the businesses I prefer have got maybe intellectual property, patent protection, or they've got high switching costs. So, a lot of software companies, people, if you're using a particular sort of software in your business, it's very difficult to switch to something else because it's embedded in everything you do. So I prefer, anyway, the kind of businesses which have clear stickiness of customers. And I'm not sure that a lot of consumer businesses can demonstrate that, actually. There's a lot of, there's fashion involved in a lot of it. Yeah.
And are there any other kind of broad sectors or areas you perhaps be wary of kind of in this kind of context?
So there are sectors that I personally don't invest in at all. One is the sort of banking sector, and that's because banks make quite thin profit margins, but they, magnify that up by having not much share capital and, lots of debt. And it's just quite risky. And also I'm quite wary of sectors where government can intervene, without warning at the drop of a hat, sort of thing. Think windfall taxes and things like that. I'm wary of areas like that. Another one, similar vein, would be oil and gas production, where or even mining, actually, where I leave it to other people because I can't personally predict the price of the minerals from year to year. So I'd rather go for something where I think it's easier to see a clear trajectory to ongoing, progress, so healthcare or whatever.
Yeah. Turning to, I suppose, a completely different development, but one that can perhaps come out of the blue and certainly can have a significant effect on kind of, small and mid-cap funds.
Yeah.
You kind of mentioned before recording there have been some sort of bid offers in the fund. That's a very, it's been quite a big theme for kind of UK funds in recent years. What kind of effect does it have and what's your view on it? Because, I know some fund managers, including, I suppose, some of your former colleagues on the Buffetology world who really despised kind of those bid offers, whereas some people kind of appreciate the uplift.
Yeah.
What's your kind of take on it?
Yeah. So it's a good question. I mean, I think it does depend. So, for example, this year in the fund, we've had a bid for a company called EMIS. Although listeners may or may not know EMIS, they actually provide software to about half of GP surgeries in the country. So, whether you know it or not, you've probably, there's a 50% chance your patient records are on the EMIS system. They also provide a lot of software for pharmacies, both community pharmacies and hospital pharmacies. So it's highly likely that people have encountered it perhaps without realizing. And EMIS have been bid for by a big, really big American company called United Health. And one thing that's interesting about that is that the chief executive of United Health is a guy called Andrew Whitty, who used to run Glaxo, famous British pharmaceutical company. So I think he knows exactly what he's buying. And I feel I have very mixed feelings about it. I mean, they are, United Health are paying, I think it's nearly a 50% premium to the price before they came along, which is pretty good. But then again, there are no other ways to invest in this area. There's, you know, there's one other private company that produces this kind of software, but and so we, you know, we lose, you know, probably forever the ability to invest in that part of the market. Well, why is that important? Well, it's not especially the GP software as such, because, you know, it's perhaps growing at 2% per annum. There's perhaps a bit of price increase occasionally. It's steady, but it's not wildly exciting. But of course, they've got an awful lot of data on patients and treatments and outcomes, and, you know, and this is unnamed patient data, I hasten to add. You know, the named patient data is within the control of the GP. But EMIS have got unnamed group data, and that data is intentionally incredibly powerful for example, drug companies trying to develop new treatments. And so, you know, we're losing that, the ability to invest in that for the future. So I have very mixed feelings about it. But it does depend. I mean, there's another company that has had a couple of bids a year or two back called Elementis, a chemical company. And that's an interesting situation at the moment, which almost might be said to be in play, because their largest shareholder has, with about 10% of the shares, has written an open letter basically challenging the board and saying that the record hasn't been on acquisitions has been poor, and that they think they need to be part of a larger group. And I suspect many people will agree with that. And in that situation, if that's right, that the business can't really develop and it probably does need to be part of a bigger chemical group, then it may well be the best outcome that somebody does come along and pay a premium, and that you know, everybody leaves the party with a balloon.
And it's interesting, Elementis did have quite a big bump, didn't it, on that news in terms of the valuation.
It did, yeah, quite recently, yeah.
I guess kind of sticking with the kind of M&A theme, obviously some of your holdings will be involved in their own kind of M&A, and perhaps particularly so in times like these when valuations look depressed to an extent. And you do hold Diploma, which is more of a kind of acquisitive name. What do you tend to look for if you're kind of trying to assess whether these are kind of value-adding acquisitions or not? Because, of course, many fund managers will end up selling out of companies simply because they think they're doing, you know, overly expensive acquisitions, yep, or ones that aren't particularly perhaps in line with what that company specializes in and so on.
Yeah. So, and I would be in that number, actually, of selling out of companies that suddenly become a lot more acquisitive, or fairly clearly go and buy a business which is expensive or outside their core competence. So, for example, in the past with this fund, I sold out of Avon Protection when they decided to move from gas masks to body armor, which turned out to be quite a big mistake. But there are occasionally companies, and Diploma is one of them, which have a very disciplined approach to acquisitions and a well-honed strategy, and do it regularly. And I would say that such companies typically are doing infill acquisitions regularly, rather than the word that makes me shudder is a strategic acquisition. You know, if you see that phrase, it's like, take a deep breath and look hard. So Diploma is a value-added distributor of steels used in construction equipment. It's a distributor of wiring and controls for things like aircraft and in the food and beverage sector, and more recently in the automation sector. And they also distribute into the life sciences sector. They distribute surgical equipment and diagnostic test kits and things like that. So it's almost a conglomerate, except it's got three clear divisions. So why would I not be worried about Diploma, and what am I looking at? So I look at, as I said, return on equity and return on capital employed. And if that is steady and not deteriorating too much, that will tell you over time that a company is not overpaying for acquisitions. It's buying sensibly and it's managing to maybe improve the businesses it's bought, take out some costs, develop them, and lift the returns back to the corporate level. So that's the true test. And many's the time, and I'm looking at a possible investment and it gets rejected because there's been a collapse in returns, and almost always it's because they've made expensive acquisitions and not made a decent return. So a lot of what Diploma does are very small deals, and so you won't almost be aware of them except if you look in the report and accounts at the end of the year. You'll see there might be one slightly bigger one, and then there'll be a list of say 7 or 10 that they've done, and there'll just be names and there'll be a total that they've spent and maybe a brief description of what they bought. So they're regularly doing all these little infills, but they're expanding their activities geographically or adding in sort of some product into their existing system, which has got warehousing and sales forces and all the rest of it. And they're just very disciplined about it. I'd say one thing there is that they have in their incentive scheme for management a return on tangible capital employed as an underpin. So if they don't sustain their returns on capital employed, the management will not earn their long-term incentive payments. And that is rare. I wish it were more common. And I think it's quite important. So, you know, Charlie Munger basically said, you know, but this is Warren Buffett's partner, said, show me the incentive and I will show you the outcome. It's so right. And I think it helps. So, you know, Diploma, it's an underpin. It's sort of that they've got to have a minimum, and I think it's high teens. And this measure for them includes goodwill. So the amount of money they've paid over and above assets for their acquisitions, and it includes goodwill they've previously written off or amortized. So it's quite a tough measure. It's saying you paid this, what have you made out of it? So that is a reassurance in the case of Diploma. And so I do, as well as looking at the trend in return on equity and return on capital employed for businesses, I also do look at the incentive schemes and management ownership. Because the other protection is if management have got reasonably big stake in the business. So, you know, in the case of Dunelm, which we talked about, the family, the Adderley family still own a big chunk of the company. So they're just there keeping a weather eye on it, you know. Across the fund, the average holding by management in these businesses that I own is 10%, which is quite high because that's an average. Hmm. Yeah. So I think you've got protections if you've got incentives that are right or management are in there. It just helps.
Interesting. And turning to one other, I suppose, kind of capital allocation decision, it's interesting that quite a few of your holdings in recent times, from I think Games Workshop to Fort Imprint and a few others, have upped their dividend. I imagine it is quite a case-by-case topic, really, but what is your kind of feeling there, given your, you know, so much of your focus is on the kind of return on capital employed and the, I suppose, ultimately the decisions the management is making with the money?
It is case by case, because as I said, if you've got a company making really high returns, you would logically want them to keep investing rather than give it all away back to shareholders. I think there are, and I don't, this is not an income fund, it's a total return fund. So I have companies that where the return comes almost entirely from the dividends, and I have companies where the return comes almost entirely from capital appreciation, and I actually don't mind which. So I think in terms of capital allocation, the big thing is if the company is making good returns and can invest in the business, I still want them to do that. Actually, you find that higher return businesses generate loads of cash usually. So they often find it difficult to reinvest all of it. back in the business, that it would be better if they invested more, and they actually can't find a way to do that because maybe they've got more of an established platform. It doesn't need that much investment, or they, they just have a good market share, whatever. But I'd like them to do that. But otherwise, the first thing is, well, if they are issuing shares for incentives, then we like them to go and buy those shares in the market. And so they're buying them and then issuing to the management. It means they're not increasing the number of shares in issue. They're actually using their cash to stop what we call dilution. So that's a sort of basic wish that companies would do that. And then really it depends. There's a bit more of a trend at the moment to buybacks, which I think speaks to how depressed the market has been in UK small and mid caps. And I think that's fair enough. If you can buy in shares when your company's valued below what it's worth, that's a good thing to do. And then there are companies that are paying dividends and increasing them and paying special dividends regularly as well. I really don't mind. I'm happy with all of those outcomes.
Yeah, I suppose it's a balance, and yep. Case by case, as mentioned.
It is.
Okay, well, very, very interesting stuff, but I'm afraid that is all.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All we have time for. So I just say thanks to Rosemary for joining us today, and thank you to everyone for listening. Take care.